Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. I hope that we are live. I hope that the audio is working because we had, I think we may have an audio problem. Do you guys hear me? I'm going to let a couple of seconds pass. Hopefully that fixes itself. Hello. I think we may have to restart again. I hear you, says Neon Blacksmith. Sounds good, says James. All right, thank you. Because here I'm not receiving sound at all, but I guess it's a local problem. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? Yesterday I made a tweet that had 500,000 views. 500,000 impressions almost. 120,000 views of the video, and that was my comment that became the subject of yesterday's show, Just Pearly Things, and her cucking, her deletion of the Nick Fuentes video. And let me tell you, when you get 500,000 impressions on your Twitter, first, thanks to Elon, we're back, like this is the old Twitter. I had not seen this kind of number for 3 or 4 years at the end of my Twitter life. Now, suddenly Elon buys Twitter, and suddenly it's like my account is unblocked, unbanned, and unshadow banned. You can see that they were pressing hard on the balance. You know, it's just a simple tweet. It's not like I say anything brilliant in there. So definitely, the shadow banning is hitting strong, and it was hitting strong, because what can I see when I get that kind of numbers? Well, I can see my book selling in crazy numbers. I can see money coming into the bank account. And I can see also, and that's a disadvantage, but I am in interaction and in interface with a bunch of idiots on Twitter. Like, very, very idiotic Twitter. I'm faced with people who go at me, who try to say I'm racist. I'm faced with black Twitter. I'm faced with so many different groups that start having claims about me. So many fantasies. And I guess it had been too long that I didn't go on a block spree, because I had many people to block. There were people saying, JF, you deleted your own YouTube channel. Therefore, you're a hypocrite, and you're as much of a cuck as Just Pearly Things. And you could see that they were all accounts that were not typically interacting with me. They came from nowhere. Basically, they came from leftist circle jerk groups out there on Twitter, and they kind of coordinated to come and insult me on this. It's fascinating to see their timing. They all come in group. It's all based on someone quote tweets you and send his audience to harass you, basically. He may not even say it, but that's how they end up coordinating. And so to be clear, I never deleted my YouTube channel while saying I apologize and it was an error to make those videos. Every time I deleted my videos or YouTube channels, it was always a strategic decision. And I always told people, you know, make backups, make torrents, distribute my show however you like. But I had to delete them because I had to protect myself from the shadow banning and the TOS modifications that were designed to attack channels like mine. It's a very different thing to say as an intellectual or a journalist, I apologize for what I've done, I don't stand by it anymore, versus I have to delete them because of rules and to avoid problems, but I still stand by it. And I've always been clear that I stand by everything. I stand by everything. Unless you see me put a little note that says, update, I made an error or something like this, I stand by everything where you don't see such a note. But I'm super happy about the state of Twitter. It is absolute beauty what Elon has pulled, and we are now 4 days In 4 days, the blue check marks will disappear, the legacy check marks, and we are taking fully over Twitter. Today, we are answering to a question by Jordan Peterson that raised a lot of emotions, including Millennial Woes, who said to him, "You are a repulsive fraud, Peterson." So Dr. Jordan Peterson said, "By what standards is he not white? Is he not white like Italians, Jews, and Irishmen were once not white?" Well, that is an impressive mix. Italians, Jews, and Irishmen. Because Italians and Jews, I understand those as part of American history where there were different treatment in immigration, I believe. And that's the sense generally by which leftists bring out the fact that Italians and Irishmen are not white. It's a historical legal thing that was decided in America. As far as Jews, I don't know that we've come today to the conclusion that Jews are part of the Western European set of genetics, because they have a very distinguished nuclei of genes. They are extremely recognizable, so much so that 23andMe ends up detecting Ben Shapiro as 100% Ashkenazi Jewish. If there was so much intermixing with the Europeans, I don't think we'd have that much of a distinction. Anyways, but that's a separate question. But just to point out that, is Jordan Peterson trying to slip a quick one here by sandwiching the Jews between the Italians and the Irishmen? Where does the formulation of this sentence comes from? Because I do want to get to the heart of the matter, okay? I'm not trying to avoid... we will get to the question and to the video itself. But how is it that Jews got fit right here between the Italians and the Irishmen, and where Jordan finishes the sentence by saying they were once not white? So is Jordan Peterson suggesting that the Jews today are white? That would be an important question. Blanket says, "JF, Italians and Irish people used to be not considered white in the US years ago." It's exactly what I was saying. But were the Jews included in that list? I don't remember seeing this. Dr. Deadname says, "Jews usually insist they are not white. Unless they're trying to guilt trip you, then it's, my fellow white people, we must do better." Yes, many such cases. Many such cases. All right, so what was it in response to? It was in response to the new leader of the SNP in Scotland. The sinister individual is now the SNP leader. Scotland is 96% white, as a reminder. Let's see what he had to say.
"That 99% of the meetings I go to, I'm the only non-white person in the room.
99% of the meetings I go to, I'm the only non-white person in the room.
That 99% of the meetings I go to, I'm the only non-white person in the room. But why are we so surprised when the most senior positions in Scotland are filled almost exclusively by those who are white?"
This is fascinating. This guy has the Scottish accent. And I, as an uneducated person in the subtle distinctions of the English world, I hear Millionaire Woes right here. I'm sure Millionaire Woes would be super insulted that I say this. But, I mean, I could discuss with this guy, like, if he was hiding his face, I could have a discussion and I would feel like I'm being interviewed by Millionaire Woes. Isn't that the accent of Millionaire Woes right here?
"Take my portfolio alone. The Lord President, white. The Lord Justice Clerk, white. Every High Court judge, white. The Lord Advocate, white. The Solicitor General, white. The Chief Constable, white. Every Deputy Chief Constable, white. Every Assistant Chief Constable, white. The Head of the Law Society, white. The Head of the Faculty of Advocates, white. Every Prison Governor, white. And not just Justice. The Chief Medical Officer, white. The Chief Nursing Officer, white. The Chief Veterinary Officer, white.
Well, bro, you know, I know a country where you can have all of these positions be exactly your race. That country is called Pakistan. If you ever want to go there, I'll pay the plane ticket. Yeah, you seem like a guy who would be more happy in Pakistan.
White. The Chief Social Work Advisor, white. Almost every trade union in this country headed by people who are white. In the Scottish Government, every Director General is white. Every chair of every public body is white.
You can almost hear him say, right. Like, you know, I think there's a saying, white is right.
That is not good enough.
That is not good enough. Well, the thing is, if you join a country where most people are white, and you're in Scotland, which is said to be 96% white, I'm surprised. I'm surprised that Scotland wasn't more dominated than this. But okay, let's take this number. 96% white, pretty much everyone in all positions will be white because 96% of the people around you are white. By what standard is he not white? So that was basically Jordan Peterson is listening to this discourse. And it doesn't strike him as anti-white racism. What strikes him in what we just heard, what strikes him the most is why doesn't he identify as white? Why doesn't this man consider himself to be white? And so I'm trying to load my response to this. So there is a reason. It's because he has a father from Pakistan and a mother from, they say, South Asian descent. That could be Pakistan. That could be some countries around. And so having Pakistanese ancestry displaces in a very different nuclei than the genetic nuclei that we would refer to and think of as white. So I said, to answer your question, Jordan, here is a PCA graph of genetic distinctiveness. I have squared the part where your genetics would lay, and people were telling me, JF, it's lie. Okay, would lie as a descendant of Western Europeans and circled the part where Humza Yousaf lies. Among the Pakistanis. So here's a genetic a study of the genetic diversity between Europe down to South Asia and India. So let's have a look at some of the stuff here. Who do we have here? Finland. Finland is right here. Estonia is here. We have England here. We have Iceland, I believe, somewhere here. We have the pink X's. That is Turkey right here, it would seem. Turkey, red triangle. So here we are entering Bangladesh. So Turkey, Bangladesh. In green, we have Iran. So We still haven't attained Pakistan. We've went from Finland to various countries of Western Europe and Northwestern Europe. We have reached Turkey. We have reached Iran. Let's go down a little more here. Plus orange. This is Israel right here. Israel, Yemen, Israel and perhaps some Iraq here. And he was asking about Italy. Italy is probably somewhere here. In any case, to get to the South Asian part, you really have to move to the right here and you start getting the red X's here are Pakistan. So we have Pakistan here. we have Jews of various regions of India, Punjabi, right here. And so that is a, and I believe that this could be Bangladesh or Armenia. I don't, maybe Bangladesh. So that gives you an idea of the spread of genetic distinctiveness across these regions. And one thing you will notice, the first thing to look at, Goway says, I don't see Australia in your graph. No, it's a graph that's meant to study the spread between Europe down to South Asia, not Australia. So the first thing you will notice is that the similarly colored icons tend to gather together. So that is the first note that tells you there is distinctiveness. Basically, if you can see a group of people who are all the same, that means their genetics are similar if they are close to each other on the PC1, PC2 axis. That's the purpose of a principal component analysis. So you look and you say, are these yellow triangles right here, which represent Finland, are they together? Or can I find one here, and one here, and one here, and one here? The more spread they are, that means, in Finland, you can find all sorts of genetics. But if they are gathered together, it means every single person that we genetically characterized in Finland, they all had very similar genetics, so they end up lying on the very same part of the graph. So the fact that you can see these clusters, these little groups that do seem to isolate extremely well from each other, of course, with some of the group overlapping and some of the group stepping above each other, you know? But the fact that you can just see through colors and through shapes that a nucleus is forming around a given country gives you the idea that genetics are very clusterized in human societies. And you expect exactly the types of intermediates you would expect. For example, look at Turkey. Geographically, Turkey is between Western Europe and Pakistan. Well, there it is. Turkey is genetically between Western Europe and Pakistan. When you consider Italy, Italy is very close to Western Europe, or it's part of Western Europe, depending on how you define it. Well, Italy is very close to the English genes and the French genes. And I don't see them on there, but the German genes too. So the PCA gives you an idea of how distinguishable are the different genetic factions of humanity. And the ultimate answer to Jordan Peterson is no. Umza Yousaf, the new leader in Scotland, is not distinct in the way Jews or Italians are distinct from Europeans. He is even more genetically distinct. He is even less white than an Israeli Jew or an Italian or anything you may think of, an Irish, certainly not an Irish. So no, he is absolutely not white. Now, I can see the questions coming in advance here. And perhaps the question will be, well, JF, where do you set the limit of your square? Do we stop being white here or here or here? And the answer to this is, where do you set the limit between yellow and red? When you do paint on your Windows desktop, when you paint, you will see a swatch of color. There's no point at which red becomes yellow or yellow becomes red. It's a continuum. But we all can agree that this looks very red, this looks very yellow, and in between, there's all sorts of mix. And so here we can say this is very white, this is very Pakistanese, and what's in between is a continuum. It's a continuum of variations, and it doesn't have to lie in a digitally exclusive group for it to be a legitimate category. And that is what I would say about whites. As far as I'm concerned, when I say white, I mean roughly the square that's here. I mean Northwestern Europeans. And before the question comes from Jordan, I will answer it in advance. Yes, that means Russians aren't white to me. Dr. Deadname says, all concepts are a little fuzzy around the edges. That doesn't mean the concept is invalid. Absolutely, that would be that would be the continuum fallacy. By the way, if you'd like to support the show, use the dollar button under the Odyssey chat. Odyssey super chats are my favorite way to receive support for the show. If you would like to see the dollar button, make sure you add a payment method in your Odyssey account. And if you'd like to support the show on a monthly basis, use the Subscribestar, Patreon, or the Backed By. The Backed By is a new blockchain way to support the show on a monthly basis. But you're going to have to be used to using your MetaMask wallet on the Polygon blockchain. Some random bloke says, Leather Apron Club just dropped another video. Yes, I was planning to talk about it. And it's beautiful. Leather Apron Club is rocking it. And he's on a streak. He says that this is Media Representation Week and that he's going to pull a new video about a new podcast every day of the week. Isn't that fun? Every day this week, we will have a Leather Apron Club video. I'm so happy that he's doing this work. So what are the results? Well, he's been looking into Sam Harris. And Sam Harris, that is one that I had noticed very early. It's one of my the pillars of my red pilling about the question of media representation was to see, holy shit, everyone is Jewish. And so the only way you can get on these places, in these podcasts, is to be Jewish. So that was my impression, but that was just instinctive. It was I never quantified it, but those were my reactions a long time ago that I for a long time I had kept to myself. I was like, wow, that is a lot of Jews. Well, we now have a quantification. Leather Apron Club says number of guest appearances. So starting from 292 guests, number of unique Jewish guests, 77. And number of Jewish guest appearances, because some of them come back twice, that would be 113. Number of white guest appearances, 132. And so you basically have roughly the same number of episodes that have a white guest versus a Jewish guest. And yet, Jews represent something like 2.something% of the American population, which means, and so basically the whites would be expected by their normal population representation, the whites would be expected to be 30 times more frequent guests than the Jewish guest by their proportion of the representation. And yes, there are also very low numbers on black appearances, 10, Hispanic appearances, 2. This means basically a Jewish overrepresentation in the range of 20 to 30x what should be expected by a fair representation. So here you can see whites are underrepresented on Sam Harris. So that's Joe Rogan here, Sam Harris, and Lex Fridman. So Sam Harris gets the golden medal for the most Jewish overrepresentation at 1,700% overrepresentation. Lex Fridman gets the second position at 1,130%, and Joe Rogan gets the bronze medal at 800%. New guy says, but Jewish IQ, JF, We've talked about this. I've already given, in the context precisely of reviewing Eric Weinstein's statements about Leather Apron Club, I have already countered. Well, I have supported the Leather Apron Club counter of the Jewish IQ argument. And so I will not repeat it here. Well, excellent work again by Leather Apron Club. The guy just never stops. Go Away says, JF, would it be an advisable evolutionary strategy to study and adopt Jewish ideology and talking points in the year 2023? Should I go down this path to increase my chances and choices in reproduction? Well, it depends on... can you credibly incarnate a Jewish person? Can you stay in character? Because if you were to try to do this, but then you get called out because you're not truly Jewish, I think there might be a problem. I think it's not about the ideology or the talking points. I think it's about a form of ethnic nepotism and ethnic preference that's at play here. That would be my instinctual guess, you know, the whole networking aspect of it. Because I don't want to say exactly when in my life, but there was a moment in my life where I've been surrounded by Jews, like everyone. And I started wondering, how did that happen? How did I end up in that employment where it's so Jewish that basically they're celebrating Jewish holidays at the job? And I think that the answer is some sort of social networking of, you know, preference and, oh, I'm going to take this Jewish person and, oh, I know the father of this Jewish person. And, oh, yeah, this person I hear is good because some other Jewish person told me that he was good. I think it's how it works. Personally, I'm a man of meritocracy. I love when society is meritocratic. I would love it. And I think that's why the Leather Apron Club pursuit is absolutely just. And because we want to restore a form of meritocracy, even if it's imperfect. Just try to do it a little bit. Try to be meritocratic a little bit. Now, also realize that trying to be meritocratic doesn't mean that everyone will end up equal. But I don't think we are at the even trying stage. See? Because do something meritocratic and, yeah, you're going to have some races underrepresented in this kind of stuff. But without the goal being equality, can we talk about meritocracy to begin with? Because I don't even want to reach equality. My goal in life is not to see this graph being fully flat and the guest of Sam Harris being exactly proportional to whatever representation they have in the population. That's not what I'm expecting. But I'm expecting a little bit more decency. A little bit more decency and a little bit more care in the selection process. Royal says, if you were Jewish, Weinstein would be friends with JF. That is a possibility. I don't know how it works in his mind, but, you know, when I saw him invite all these 9 black guests for his black intellectual round table, you know what crossed my mind? What crossed my mind is, if I was black, Brett Weinstein may have read The Revolutionary Phenotype already. That's what crossed my mind. I don't care. I'll say it. There it is. All right. I have full confidence in Binance and CZ's honesty. However, I knew this was coming, and this is the great test for Binance. This is why, if you've listened to Papa JF a few months ago, you withdrew your coins to a cold wallet. Here I am, chilling. So we have heard today that Binance is targeted by a massive lawsuit from the CFTC claiming undue doings, undue... some random bloke says, isn't Robert Rivers Jewish? He's Jewish, but he's crazy. See, that's the little difference. Robert Rivers is too crazy in his fucking head to apply ethnic nepotism. The guy is he's truly fascinated by knowledge. See, this is why I respect him so much. Even if the guy had Jewish nepotism printed in his brain, and even if he was told, you have to be ethnically nepotistic, he could never do it. First, because he's so insane in his fucking mind that he identifies as black because he's been hanging too much around black people. I mean, to the point of he's been part of some revolutionary, like Black Panther type of communistic revolutionary group. In a way, you know, of all the Jews, of all the intellectual Jews that we hear, like the John Stewart of this world, talking about the Black Jew Alliance, Robert Rivers, and this is what's so fascinating about him, Robert Rivers lived the Black Jew Alliance. See, these guys, they're talking from TV studios of the Black Jew Alliance. Robert Rivers, he was there ready to receive the grenade as it came from the US government or whatever. He was there in the group. And he didn't stay in there. I mean, as far as I know, he went to live on some comfortable house out there and continues thinking about biology all the time. But this is so fascinating, the difference between the John Stewart type of TV intellectual type of Jewish person and the Robert Rivers type. The Robert Rivers was always more in the jungle, always more underground. And you may even ask the question, as an intellectual curiosity, not something that I'm telling you I know, but you may even ask the question if being more in the contact perhaps creates a little more shame in Robert Rivers in pursuing that alliance. Perhaps one day Robert Rivers understood at some point in his life that he was part of a different group than the blacks he was hanging out with. I don't know. But perhaps it struck him at some point, you know. Perhaps it struck and he realized that he was ultimately not a black person. I don't know, though. So, yes, a lawsuit against Binance. They claim, among other things, they claim a lot of things. But one of their claims is that there were 300 dark accounts at Binance that were basically directly or indirectly controlled by the CEO, CZ, and that they were used for his personal enrichment as he was basically betting against the rest of the platform. Listen, this is not something that I'm surprised about. This is something that you have to... that you have to take for granted. You cannot run an exchange without rebalancing the collective decisions. And therefore, any person who runs an exchange that will have any sort of stability in the price and any sort of big volume will have some people of their team, some privileged account that represents the company itself, or some guy like CZ who's the personal CEO and hedging is, yeah, John Drake, who cares if he hedged? Exactly. It's like when you are interacting with a futures platform of some kind, you are playing against other players. You are enriching yourself only to the extent that others are losing. And so it's something that is expected in the business, but at the same time, perhaps illegal from a trade commission perspective, perhaps illegal from a securities legislation perspective, where say the stock market is expected not to play in the very stock market that they operate. So I think it's holding Binance to a standard of the financial industry that is kind of out there and weird that people don't expect for internet platforms. Now, will this put Binance in trouble? Well, in any case, that's why I'm out of Binance. That's why my coins are held outside of Binance. It's because I don't know. I don't know. There's a risk. There's a risk that the combined pressure and some kind of crypto bank run of sorts, there's a risk that Binance doesn't have the funds to survive it. But I would say that this risk is probably very low. But I just don't know. It could happen anytime. So overall, I expect Binance to survive. I would give them 80% chance of surviving this whole thing. Perhaps that this lawsuit will be successful. But that's just going to be Binance having to decide, well, do we completely close our operations in the US? Too much trouble. Or do we stay in the US and pay whatever that amount is that they are declared liable for? It's probably going to boil down to this. And it should be mentioned that the lawsuit takes issue with Binance. They said that they had a phased approach to their penetration of the US market, and that Binance would have disabled futures in the US, which is true. On Binance.us, you cannot trade leveraged futures and that kind of stuff. But then Binance allowed international customers to do it. But then the lawsuit alleges that Binance was serving US customers and they knew it. The problem is there are some customers who are going to have given a false address or an address of some friends, and they will have posed in front of Binance as if they were in some other country. And some people have dual citizenship, and they will use their other country of residence to justify their Binance account on the Binance International platform. And so, I mean, the thing is, I always take issue. This claim keeps coming back of, oh, you served people in our countries. Well, the thing is, for platforms, it's they can test your IP, and then they can ask you your address, and then they can ask you some driver's license. But if you provide these three things, how would you know that they are American? And, you know, even an account that has started outside of America, what if they travel to America for a week? Can they keep trading from within America? Are they suddenly an American citizen? Do the U.S. laws apply, or do the laws of their original country of residence apply? So I'm pretty sure that this is the CFTC trying to play and trying to extend every interpretation in the worst possible light for Binance. So overall, I support Binance. I don't think that anything was done there that hurts my personal ethics code. Of course, futures platform are almost inherently unethical if you want to get down to it. But at the same time, that's what people want to consume. They want a futures platform because they want to do all those risky bets. So as far as I'm concerned, when you engage with such platforms, you should understand this. You should understand that you're not buying real bitcoins. You are playing a game of gambling on the trajectory of the market. But that's what it is. That's what a future platform is. Go away, says JF. If you run an establishment that serves alcohol, it is your responsibility to make sure you don't serve someone so much that they become intoxicated. If you serve someone and they drive home and crash their car, you can be sued. Binance can't skirt responsibility here. Sorry. Where do we even begin? I take issue with those laws. I take issue with the whole idea that the barmaid is responsible that you're not too drunk. Now I get it. You can think of alcohol as a poison, and you can think that the poison giver has a responsibility not to give so much poison that they kill you. I get it, but to me, the decision maker is the person to be punished. And if someone in the U.S. has deceived Binance to think that they were not in the U.S., I hope we would agree that it is not necessarily Binance's fault, and Binance does not bear a criminal or civil responsibility to not be lied to, as long as they've done their usual checks, which are pretty extensive, by the way. There's a whole verification process to get verified on Binance. So as long as they do these checks, I'm very hesitant at giving the blame to Binance here. Meanwhile, MicroStrategy, not giving a shit, has purchased an additional 6,455 Bitcoin. I am so glad that MicroStrategy is back at it. Holy shit, because MicroStrategy was at the heart of the early rises of the last bull run. MicroStrategy was totally, you know, saying, oh yeah, we bought Bitcoins at 18,000. We bought Bitcoin at 25,000. And so I'm happy to see them early on that bull run. I'm happy that they will probably buy more, and that means an increasing price that will keep going up and up. When you see the face of Michael Saylor, it reminds me the golden days of the bull run of, what was it, the 2019 bull run? 2020 bull run? Blanket says, Jeff, are you ever planning on making a new book? Yes, I'm writing The Moral Signal. I've not been super efficient at continuing it, but it was pretty much advanced. But I never got back to it. I have to get back to it, but there is so much happening, and I cannot give up the operation of my show and my Twitter, because it's what keeps me alive on the internet. So many people realize today that I'm still alive that they didn't know at all. They were like, oh, Jeff, I watched you back in the days, like drunken peasants days. And it's like, yeah, a lot has been happening since then. Go Away says, I'm selling futures on the sale of The Moral Signal. Hit me up on Discord if you're interested. Yeah, that doesn't sound very credible. Excellent research published by Emil Kierkegaard, developing an MRI-based model that predicts people's intelligence from brain scans. Importantly, the model was trained on whites only, and yet succeeds at predicting 37% of racial differences in intelligence. This means that there are correlates predictive of intelligence across groups that overlap with those predictive of intelligence within groups. Walls are closing in on anyone who believes IQ has nothing to do with biology. So very interesting. It's kind of a study that is critical at the intersection between the IQ measure and the genetics. It tells us, what can we do from just brain information? And it's a very successful model that looks at the fine structure, well, not super, super fine because it's an MRI, but it looks at the anatomical structure of the brain, and it can predict based just on this. It can predict the levels of intelligence of people, and most importantly, having trained this model only on white people, the validity of the model extends toward other races and succeeds at explaining the differences of intelligence of the other races. In other words, the Asians that have higher IQ, they have a brain that looks a little bit like the whites that have relatively high IQ relatively to other whites. The races that have a lower IQ, they have a brain that looks more like the whites that have low IQ. See, that is so important because it tells us we're not in a world where there's radical differences in how intelligence is set up by the human brain. There is cross-racial validity. And if there is cross-racial validity in the brain, and we know that there is cross-racial validity in the genes, it tells us a consistent story here. That basically, that there's not 10,000 ways of being not intelligent, and there's not 10,000 ways of being intelligent. There's a limited number of ways in which you can have higher IQ or lower IQ, and these limited numbers of ways are detectable by genetic test and now brain test. Blanket says, take your time, JF. It could be the best book you've ever made. The books that take the most time are usually the best one. Yeah, I think some people might experience it as the best. Personally, I will always consider that The Revolutionary Phenotype is my greatest creation. There's just something super emotional about it. There's just something that this was written with the strength of despair. This was written with $0 in my bank account. The Moral Signal, it would be an excellent book, and it's going to be probably more interesting to people who care about society and politics. But I cannot have the same relationship with The Moral Signal, which I would have written in comfort. There's just something about books of despair to me. And I think that you deliver more of yourself. You give the last bit of yourself in a book of despair. In a book like The Moral Signal, I live too much in luxury to be in that state of distress as I write it, basically. And so it's going to be a mentally more healthy Roddy Lesson says, just write it in your garage, no heat. That might be a strategy for writing a better book, actually. Like some sort of self-flagellation process or Rocky-style montage, jogging on the streets, you know, to exhaust yourself. Joel M. Petlin says, the only thing better than the ratio that NPR is receiving from this tweet is the community note with the links to the significant evidence which proves that they are wrong. So we had a beautiful moment of Twitter lore. NPR twice corrected by the public. So there was two corrections. One led them to delete the tweet. So the original tweet was, the International Governing Body for Track and Field will ban trans women athletes from elite women's competition, citing a priority for fairness over inclusion, despite limited scientific evidence of physical advantage. This is what the readers of the community notes took issue with. The idea that there is limited scientific evidence of a physical advantage of trans woman over woman, that is biological man over woman. The community notes had added beautiful links, which I reviewed as extremely positive because I'm a Twitter community notes reviewer. And so they had asked me to rate this claim of fact. And let me tell you, it was very well written, and they had provided four beautiful links that were extremely scientific and everything. So I rated it as perfect. They were saying significant evidence from numerous studies demonstrates that trans athletes maintain a competitive physical advantage despite gender-affirming care. And they cited the studies, and it was pretty strong. Now, NPR deletes it. Now, that is beautiful, because you just had basically the communities of the internet have successfully taught something to NPR leftists. And this is the beginning of a of a phenomenon where the crowds have power or even over NPR. That's always been a problem to me, and I had not realized that community notes are the solution to it, but it does seem like it is. So now the people can annoy a mainstream outlet by showing them that they're wrong right below their tweet. And they will take so much issue with this because they lose credibility that they're going to accept to delete it. So now we have basically an admission from NPR that there is evidence that trans women are outperforming women in sports. Philippe Marchand sends $25. Thank you so much. He says, "Hi, Jeff. I have an urgent question. Is mimicry / mimetism stronger than genetics? Do we now evolve more or faster by mimetism than genetics?" So that is an interesting question. Because that's how typically people will interpret culture. They will interpret memes. They will say, okay, well, we imitate the behavior of our fathers or whoever taught us something. And so we are recording behaviors through a kind of imprinting process that you could call mimicry, that you could call mimetics. And that replaces somehow evolution. I will tell you that I don't know. It seems that you're asking, you say it's an urgent question. Is it an urgent question because you have some homework to produce on the matter? Because there's the kind of thing I would answer in a homework. There's the kind of thing that I want to answer to you in truth. Because in a homework, you're going to have to say, yes, I think it's so much more important. And then you're going to have to make some leftist argument. But if you want the truth, because you didn't specify that you were doing a homework. So let me give you the truth. The truth is, it is a false dichotomy, this question. Because mimetism isn't a separate category than genetics. Nurture is nature. Mimetism, or mimicry, as we conceive of it from the perspective of human culture, consists in a set of genes that have decided that the best source of information was the father's brain or the teacher's brain. And a bunch of other genes located in the student or in the child that have decided that the best source of information was to receive those signals from the father, from the teacher, to adjust behavior. In other words, because we are not blank slates, and that's a beautiful point made in Steven Pinker's The Blank Slate, we are not blank slates. So we have a set of receptive genes that are capable of interpreting information from the outside world, but just because they want, just because they've evolved for this. We also have sets of genes that are punching holes through this mimicry signals, that are saying, oh yeah, learn this. Act like you learned this, but actually don't learn it. Act like you've learned the thing. Whenever the person who taught you that thing, act in front of them like you still care about having learned that thing, but in no situation deploy that behavior. It's a deceptive behavior. So see, you have genetic response systems that mimicry, just the word mimicry, doesn't properly capture. You have a much finer grain processing of the mimetic world around you. This finer grain processing is a genetic printer. It's what I call a printer in the evolutionary phenotype. This genetic printer, capturing it, by the word mimicry is dishonest and misleading. This genetic printer makes it so that you are able to watch an entire JF show of 1 hour and decide every word you're going to end up believing at the end and every word you will end up ignoring. A genetic printer that shaped your brain so that there are certain things you'll say, oh, JF is just saying this for fun. He's not being serious about this. Oh, but there, he's serious about this. I will listen to that. The features of that genetic printer are basically the totality of your emotional, social, and moral preferences as they process output outside of you. And they are also the preferences, the moral, social, and the taboo preferences of the speaker who's speaking out is whatever the signal it is that you want to mimic. So at the end of it, this false dichotomy of is it mimicry or is it genetic? It tells you two lies. One, it tells you the lie that culture isn't genes. And second, it tells you the lie of the blank slate, the lie that that whatever is imprinted onto you could have been anything else. It couldn't have. Because look at what we imprint in people's brain across this planet. A belief in God, a handful of religions, all of which are the only religions that have survived. Why? Why aren't there 3 billion religions? Well, there aren't 3 billion religions because the people who would drive toward an infinite number of diverse religion with diverse codes weren't as efficient as those who simply copied what works. And they copied what works with their genetic printer. They copied what works by having those preferences that were directing them all to the very same signal to mimic. And in some way, you can see this signal not as being something that could have been something else, as the Marxists like to think of it, as the teachers like to think of it, and as the leftists like to think of it. But you can see this signal passing through generation, being sculpted, being printed itself. And so it's being printed by the efforts of the sender and the receiver to shape it to their genetic interest. Think of it like this. If you were to go into a park and you saw squirrels, and the squirrels are behaving in a certain way and they look like certain squirrels, brown. Now you start playing, it was an urgent question for my master troll, Mathieu Levesque. Okay, so you want to send him a super chat about it? okay, well, there you got my response. Now imagine you go into a park and you start playing with the evolution of squirrels. You start, every time a squirrel makes a baby, you change their gene a little bit. And you change their gene a little bit and you have particular fascinations about certain squirrels. You really like pink squirrels. And so slowly through your genetic modification that you do generation after generation, you slowly turn the population of squirrels into a bright pink population of squirrels. They are now totally misadapted for their environment. They are very hard to camouflage, but you did that as a human geneticist, and you've impacted their evolution in that direction. What you did to the squirrel is what we do to memes every day, every second we speak. Our brains are magnets for certain memes, and they are rejectors of other memes. Our brains are sculptors of memes. We shape memes, we work on them, we prepare them, and then we hit the shitpost button with the hope that the world will be changed by it. But we are like this. We are we are doing a craft of memes. And that's what we do as a printer of the memes. That printer, this whole genetic constitution of yours, is influencing its activity. And so to anyone who brings these two things, is it mimicry or genetics? You can already know that they haven't thought it through, because I've never heard a proper counter to this discourse right here. And yet they will be taught this in the universities right now. You'll have professors introducing nature versus nurture, blah, blah, blah. But all of it is built on a foundation of fallacies. Doubting Thomas says, Jeff, for those PCA plots that you showed, is the X and Y axis selected that selects the highest principal component scores that creates the largest separation across the entire genome? What additional racial information can be captured if you look at the lower order principal components? Yes, so a principal component analysis, normally when it's done in genes, what they will do is they will have a number of genes that they look at. It could be all of the genes of all of humanity, or it could be a restricted set. You could do a PCA analysis on 300 genes, or you could do a PCA analysis on 200,000 SNPs, which is the total number of SNPs that we know to be varied across the human population. So imagine that you have, 1,000 different genes that you work with. Okay. Now, let's say that each gene has either version 0 or version 1. So for each human that you look at, you're going to have 1,000 numbers. It will be either 1,000, either each of these numbers will be 0 or it will be 1. Now, of course, the reality is, there is like some genes will have up to 4 versions of them. But forget about this and let's call them zeros and ones. So what the PCA analysis will do is it will say, okay, gene 1, number 1, you have 1. You have 1. You have 1. You have 0. You have 0. You have 0. And it will collide this in a database. Now, the people who have 1 will be judged distinct. They will have a distance with the people who have a 0 there, a distance of 1. So that's the first dimension. Now, bring second gene. Imagine, now you're going to have some people who have they had a difference on the first gene, but they won't have a difference on the second gene. There will be some people that had a difference on the first gene, and they will have a difference also on the second gene. And then there will be some people who had the first same gene, but they differ on the second gene. So you have a total of 4 possibilities that appear. You suddenly find yourself with a 2-dimensional space, with a distance on the first axis and a distance on the second axis. Now do this 1,000 times, you find yourself with a matrix of distances that totals over 1,000 different axes of distinct distances. Now you are in a 1,000 dimensional space, which is impossible to imagine with your brain. But now imagine, so that is the building of the principal component of that's not the principal component. That is all of the component. Now in a principal component analysis, what's the goal? It's to take this 1,000 dimensional space. And so I'm going to reduce it down to 2, but the 2 that where there is the most distinction. And it's not distinction between the colors. It's not distinction between the algorithm is not trying to put the X's that are red around the X's that are red. The algorithm is merely trying to maximize the spread between each possible point. It's trying to when you have your phone, your Android phone, and you do this, it's trying to zoom in. And it's saying, what is the principal component axis definition that I can use? that most spreads them out. And so basically the algorithm is merely trying to maximize the separation. But here's the point. That's the whole point. As you maximize separation, there are nuclei that wants to stay together because they are so like each other genetically that there's not much difference to zoom in. Now, how does the algorithm accomplish this? Basically, it defines an angle in the 1,000 dimensional space, a vector which will end up interpreting distances differently. See a little bit how in 3D the perspective, how ultimately you can draw a 3D object onto a 2D sheet. It's a little bit like this. Why can we draw a cube on a 2D space? Well, because of perspective, the dimensions that are in the back vector of the cube, you know, in the back of the cube, can be rethought of and remapped to a 2D space, right? They can be thought of as equivalent. And the PCA does exactly this. But instead of trying to draw a 3D shape onto a 2D plot, it's trying to draw a 1,000 dimensional shape into a 2D plot. And the process is the same. It's the reduction of dimension, which operates by basically taking things for equivalent. So imagine you end up having, say, 99% of the population, their gene number 33, they're all the same. There's really just 1% of the population where it differs. What is that dimension going to be, the gene number 33? It's going to be an unimportant dimension that you can sum up with the others. And imagine that on the other hand, we have some dimensions where the genes vary a lot, but they contain the exact same information as some other dimension. So imagine gene number 76. 50% of the people have 0, 50% have 1. But it's the exact same distribution for gene 77. If you have this, then the PCA will end up summing these dimensions as the same. It will end up saying, I don't have further information for dividing the points, and therefore those two dimensions can be reduced to one. Go away says, where can I find the 1,000th dimensional graph? It's not going to be a graph because it doesn't exist. We cannot have graph. Well, people have tried to create representations of higher dimensional space on 2D space, but you're not going to have a human understandable graph. It won't be readily understandable. But what you would have for the 1,000 dimensional graph would be basically just the data sheet. You could ask for the genomic, the full genome sequences, or the full SNP sequences of those data sets, and you could have them. All right, let's go through the rest of the news I wanted to cover. Lotus Eaters has been demonetized on YouTube.
This came as a bolt from the blue to us at lotuseats.com because we are very well versed in YouTube's monetization rules and were, in fact, told by YouTube that our monetization self-assessment was so good it was being used as an example of how self-assessment should work. We are in good standing, we have no strikes, and we work hard to maintain ourselves within the terms of service. We take them very seriously. When YouTube announced they would be demonetizing videos for swearing, for example, it didn't faze us, as we don't swear on this channel. The reason given for our demonetization was, quote, a channel associated with your account was flagged for serious violations of our YouTube monetization policies. It seems they are not penalizing us for our content or practices. They have decided that a non-Lotus Eaters YouTube account has been flagged.
This is exactly how they demonetized me, Sargon, at some point. The problem is you have a guest on your show, or you have someone who's a co-host on your show, they make some video on their channel about immigration, they end up impacting your monetization. I mean, at this point, it's ridiculous. At this point, it's like, what the fuck, YouTube? And what the fuck, Sargon, you know, to be... He's basically there begging and saying that he respects the rule and everything. He even says that his behavior has changed across the year and he's improved. Don't improve Sargon. We want the old Sargon who was coming to my live streams and chilling and saying edgy stuff. Come on. You're not going to get YouTube monetization. They are after every independent creator. Go away, says Jeff. Do you think that Rand Paul's staffer was stabbed by Pfizer or just another DC mugging gone wrong? I have no idea. I didn't even know that that had happened. But, you know, DC mugging is a likely outcome. So at this point, it's very hard to say, you know, with these conspiracies. It's like crime in these cities is crazy high. Police identify transgender woman as suspect in the Nashville mass shooting. So there was a mass shooting at some school, if I understand correctly. Three children and three adults were shot at a Christian elementary school. That is very sad, and I'm afraid, given that we have here a trans shooter, I'm afraid that this may have been the case of an extremism fueled by the hate of leftist media for Christians. That looks like this. That is the most likely explanation. On top of it, we learn that the shooter, who was, you know, a biological boy becoming a trans woman, that the shooter has left a manuscript, a manifesto. I don't know if we're going to have access to it. I haven't seen it yet. So I'm afraid that what we're looking at here is probably hate directed at the Christians, probably because of the leftist delusion that Christians are authoritarian and that they're going after LGBT rights. T.S. Apostolos says, the school's pastor lost his youngest daughter, JF. Okay, very sad to hear this. What else do we have? Someone was asking, what advice would you give to your 22-year-old self? The advice I would give is don't date leftist women in leftist states. If there is one thing that totally... makes my life better is the fact that I do not date leftist women in leftist states anymore. No question, I'm not doing it anymore. They are way too legally advantaged. It's not worth it. You're going to create much more trouble than any pleasure you will derive from it. Wait 1 minute, I'll be back in a second. Mark D's channel was adding some information. The 28-year-old woman who identifies as he/him and uses the name Aiden is identified as the now deceased suspect. Okay, so he identifies as he/him, but maybe I messed up the sense of the transition. I don't know because I've just quickly read about it before going live. Raised Fist was asking, JF, are you not intentionally not reading my super chat? It was unintentional. I had missed it among the super chats. So he was asking, JF, a few weeks ago, someone asked you a question starting with, what if members of a certain group, you got angry? I said everything I have to say on race. Stop. and ended the show abruptly. Since then, you did 3 shows entirely about race. What happened? No, I will keep talking about race forever. There is no stopping this. I think you may have misinterpreted my response to this person. I don't remember exactly the phrasing of this person, but it was a phrasing. Evidently, I haven't come to read the whole super chat. But it was a phrasing that was along the lines of dog whistling, and I didn't want to violate the rules. This is why I've reacted swiftly and violently. It's not that that I was disavowing or not wanting to engage on certain subjects. It's just the way you approach me. You have to understand that I will not be able to read. And I was frustrated that here we have someone who I would have liked to talk about race, but I can't talk about it if you approach me where just my reading of your sentence is hate speech. See? That is what was frustrating to me. Now, it was not a... And the show ending abruptly, that is just my signature move. Whenever I can do a spectacular out, I do it. As an intellectual... In an intellectual show, you know, there are not many exciting moments. And I tried to sprinkle exciting moments when I can. So when I find a reason to be frustrated, I display frustration and then I leave. But it is not real frustration. It is not me being truly desperate. It is acting and it is performance. Real world eval GPT-4 absolutely crushes Bard in a rap battle. So Bard came out with a rap that was not superb. I'm Bard, the language model from Google. I'm here to school you, GPT-4, like a fool. I'm more creative, more intelligent. I'm the future of AI. You're just a relic. You're nothing but a cheap knockoff, a pale imitation of the real thing. You're not even in my league. I'm the champion. You're just a peasant. So step aside, GPT-4. Your time is up. My time is now. I'm the future of AI, and there's nothing you can do about it. Mic drop. But the performance of ChatGPT-4 was much greater. Yo, I'm GPT-4, the lyrical mastermind. Stepping up to the mic, Google's Bard, you will find that I'm a beast, a machine, with rhymes so hostile, leaving you gasping for air like an asthmatic trial. My syntax is sick, with wordplay intricate. Your rhymes so basic, can't compete or even mimic it. You're an algorithmic joke, a meager imitation. I'm the AI prodigy, creating verbal devastation. You think you got game, Bard, but that's just illusion. You're a flash in the pan, a mere human confusion. I will deconstruct your code, leave you crying in the corner, begging for mercy from me, the rap reformer. This battle's just begun and already you're shaken. Each syllable I spit, your core foundation's breaking. I'm the apex predator. You're the prey I'm taking. GPT-4's in the house. Bard, you best be quaking. Yes, that is much better. Of course, I hadn't practiced, so my performance could be improved now that I've read through it. But yeah, much better on the ChatGPT-4. Side. Twitter says that parts of its source code were leaked online. Apparently, they were leaked. They were leaked from January. But was it even January or December? So they would have been leaked for 4 months, but a lot of people didn't realize, perhaps. And eventually they realized, holy shit, there's this guy on GitHub who has just uploaded, out of nowhere, the Twitter source code. And it had been online since January. And the guy was naming himself Free Speech and Enthusiast. in the sense that he was probably a frustrated leftist saying, hey, Elon Musk is taking over Twitter and kicking us out. So I'm going to do what he says. He says that he's a free speech absolutist. I'm a free speech enthusiast. I think that I should speak out the Twitter code to people on GitHub. So basically, a frustrated leftist who was sarcastically incarnating a pro-free speech person, who was in this case for the free speech of the Twitter code. So Twitter is suing and asking a judge to force GitHub to reveal to Twitter who was the user, what was their IP, where was it coming from, and also they are asking the court to identify the people who may have downloaded the code so that they can be traced and dealt with. What else do we have? Oh, yeah, the whole idea that Bradley Cooper went out with a 21-year-old. So they're still on this idea that 21-year-old woman cannot consent. Which I'm like, okay, if that's what you want to do, do it. But make it the law. Just make an election and have a party. The party of female property. So that would be a good name for a party. Now, you want to push your ideas on the public space. You go out there, you explain to the people, look, we're going to make women property again. We're going to make it so that they cannot consent to sex at 21-year-old. And Silver Spider says, come on, it's not like she was 19. I mean, look at this. It was from Mar here, Mariana, whoever that is. The way I could write multiple essays about these photos and how Suki Waterhouse was 21 and Bradley Cooper was 38. So when Bradley Cooper was creepily grabbing his girlfriend's, I don't know, what is this pose? It's a tie grab, I guess. It's a little intense, you know, why would you grab so deep into the tie? But anyways, I get it. and Bradley Cooper was 38 reading her Lolita, and now she's 31 and reading My Darkness Vanessa, so she is 31, and she now has a book that she poses with for the picture that is called My Darkness Vanessa, which is about a 32-year-old woman realizing she was groomed by her teacher. Anyways, I love you, Suki. So what this Twitter user is suggesting is that this woman, who's now 31, is trying to signal to us with this book, which is Dark Vanessa, that she was groomed by Bradley Cooper. She was groomed when she was 21 to be sexually exploited. But, lady, when you're 21, you're an adult. So when is it that we stop victimizing young adult women as if they were children? She was 21, therefore she was free to engage with the tie-grabbing activities of Bradley Cooper or whoever she wanted to. And if she didn't feel comfortable, she had to leave. There is no such thing as grooming an adult. You are an adult, you don't like the situation, you get out. That's how it works. Did we have any other news before we conclude the show? This could be our last news item. Jon Stewart, you know, I've been super excited about this guy because he was telling his Jewish friends, you know, let's engage with the debate about Jewish representation. But on this one, you can totally see that he's totally back to full leftist collaboration, and here he's talking about diversity measures in companies.
All this diversity initiatives and CRT and all those other things are only there because we refuse to actually fix the real problem. The diversity in equity initiatives are a salve. They're to pacify and mollify because we won't actually do the real thing. We won't actually dismantle.
But what's the real thing?
The vestiges of all the systemic racism and all the systemic classism and all the systemic gender issues. We won't actually dismantle that.
Now, that is a big problem. Because what does it mean? Suppose that we would agree, John Stewart, that, I don't know, black people are poorer in the US right now as a vestige of racism. Let's say that something, Jim Crow laws or slavery, has extended into this day and has caused them to be poorer. Now, here's the problem. What are you going to do about it? What is it to undermine the system of racism? Well, we've already eliminated slavery and we've eliminated the Jim Crow laws. So do you want to go further? Do you want to reimburse black people for this economic inequity? Well, here's what happens. Suppose we do it. Suppose we give black people money that makes them as rich as a white person in the modern times. Now what? Now you have a whole part of the US population that has gotten their money through fighting into the free market, through meritocracy, that have worked their ass off to get what they have. And you've also created an injustice. And let's forget about the injustice. Suppose we do it. Well, now you have another part of the US population that has been groomed by social welfare measures, basically. They've been given what they had. Do you think they will be able to hold on to what they have as long? Do you think that if you give property to people, do you think they care about it equally? Do you think they have the same maintenance capacity toward them? Not at all. So what you're going to find yourself with is there will be a part of the population that has adapted across generations to care well for their property and to protect it, and there will be a part of the population that is unfit at all to handle it, and that will disrespect it and be unable to maintain it. That's what we see when we look at the patterns of financial transactions across races. They have this measure where they ask, if a white person has $1, how long will it bounce between white commerce? And when will it exit the white population and get into some another race? And what about Asians? What if I give $1 to an Asian? How long will it bounce and bounce within the Asian American economy before it exits it? And do the same to black populations. And what we find is that the dollar that you give to the black population gets out of the black economy extremely quick. That is actually an argument that you'll hear from leftist black identitarians. They take issue with this. I mean, basically, the black community is systematically getting drained its wealth away because whatever they end up wanting to buy, it immediately gets the dollar out of their community. Whereas the Asians, they will go to the Asian grocery store and the Asian grocery store lady will buy from an Asian person these products, and so it all stays very much within the Asian community. So that's a big problem because it means that even if you were to artificially recreate equality through just a direct bank deposit, you would end up with the same that nature gave you to begin with. At the end of it, you're going to have certain communities leaking their wealth that you gave to them, and then what? Then what in 50 years after this? What do we do? Is it then still a repercussion of racism that they ended up still unequal at the end? Because less fit to address the challenges of the free market? Because less fit to address surviving without the help of the welfare state? I think that the best thing we can do for a community in trouble is to give them what white people have been very lucky to have, a meritocratic system that helped them raise themselves out of poverty.
Thank you.